Greetings from Astro City, Sega fans. It's the Sega guys, beaming arcade goodness through the internet straight into your brain. I'm Dan the Mega Driver, joined as ever by the Dreamcast to my Naomi. It's James the Segaholic. How you doing, mate?
I'm very good, mate. Very good. How's yourself?
Yeah, good. Thought I'd keep it simple, you know, with that intro. Normally try and be clever with it, but I thought, given today's subject, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? You know, they're the same, but not, you know. It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
It's like that gif, isn't it? Same, same, different, but still the same. I mean, so, aye, one and the same. Same family, same architecture, slightly different specifications, but yes, we are of course talking about the Naomi and its links to Dreamcast.
Yes, and I know we talk about supermodels on the show a few times, but we're not talking about supermodel Naomi Campbell. We are talking, of course, about the Sega arcade hardware that was Naomi. And James, I think, what better place to start than what is the Naomi? And I learned something today. I learned that Naomi actually stands for New Arcade Operation Machine Ideas.
Yeah.
I feel like I might have known that, but I might have forgotten it. But yeah, I was like, oh.
It's always nice to find that these little kind of, what these acronyms all say, it wasn't named after a woman, you know, I would imagine. It's one of the guys in the team, that ex-girlfriend or something, it's like, ah, name it after Naomi. But no, I say it's interesting as well that Sega, you know, went down the route of, you know, superseding the Model 3 board with hardware that was based on their new home console. It was almost, I think we'll go into that in a bit more detail later on, you know, but it was a clever move because while Dreamcast was very much marketed, or not so much marketed, but the hype around it when it was being unveiled and stuff was that it's Model 3 in the home. And then we had the kind of VF3 port and the Sega Rally 2 port, and people started kind of picking holes and going, it's not quite Model 3 perfect. And then Sega kind of decided, well, hold on a minute, we'll base Model 3's successor on the Dreamcast, which then means that ports to Dreamcast will be closer to the arcade. So it was a pretty clever move on Sega's part.
It really was, and if you think back to when Naomi first launched, and obviously we first heard about it at the New Challenge Conference, wasn't it? And I believe it was that same New Challenge Conference that they announced the Dreamcast that they also announced Naomi. Obviously, the prospect of a new arcade board, a lot more common to see new arcade boards than it was to see, say, new home hardware at the time, was a little bit understated during the presentation, but it was quite a massive thing, because obviously, at the time, you know, when we're talking about early 98, before this announcement, the Model 3 board was still the most powerful arcade hardware out there. You know, say, reading today, you know, Sega were in the Guinness Book of World Records because they were the most prolific arcade operator, you know, of all time. They've made more arcade games than anyone, more arcade hardware. And at the time, you know, they'd won the arms race with Namco. Namco kind of got to System 22, which was the Ridge Racer board, and basically threw in the tower, you know, couldn't beat Model 2. And then Sega went Model 3. There was no answer to that either. So it ended up, Sega had won the arms race effectively, you know, the hardware race to get the most advanced visuals in the arcade. And, you know, because Model 3 was the benchmark, it was kind of, how do you beat that? And it was kind of a left field approach, wasn't it, to go with Naomi? Because as far as, you know, the Model 1, Model 2, and even going back to the Super Scalers, Sega's System 11, or their own Super Scaler board, System 32, they were always so far above the home consoles at the time. So Naomi, in itself, in essence, wasn't quite the jump on that basis that you were used to seeing from Sega in the arcade.
I don't know if it was maybe their intention that if... Because like Model 3... I would like to see kind of spec for spec whether Model 3 and Naomi, how far ahead one was of the other. But I think it was more a case of Sega wanting to get more parity, because like Naomi is still a very, very powerful board. Like Dreamcast games, like that are based on Naomi games, they hold up incredibly well today. You're like a Power Stone's Dead or Alive 2, stuff like that. They still look glorious. So, you know, I think the other thing comes into it as well is that Naomi was a lot cheaper as well. Yeah. cheaper to buy, cheaper to program for. It also meant that home ports were like ridiculously easy. Like if you look at, and we have done that again through the kind of list of games, like if you look at on like Sega Retro or Wikipedia and look at the release dates, like you look at when it came out in the arcade, and then you look at when it came to Dreamcasters, I think the biggest gap in some is like 6 months at most, if not, but a lot of them are a lot less, you know. And as I say, obviously by the time this comes out, the video that I did on the Naomi games that came out following the Dreamcast's discontinuation, and when I was doing that video as well, and I was looking, I'm going like, there's 2 months between that, 3 months between that. It's like it did give like in a small teams with smaller budgets a platform to get something out in the arcades and know that it could just be smacked onto a GD-ROM quite easily, and they could easily replicate that in the home, which again was something that we've seen with Model 3. People were picking holes in Dreamcast ports because the build up to it and all the supplements and like Edge magazine and stuff like that. It was, you know, Sato talking about it, that Dreamcast pushes more polygons in Model 3, and but it's because Model 3 uses, was it Model 3 used quads and Dreamcast uses triangles?
That's
So
right, yeah.
yeah, so it was something like Model 3 does, was it 1 million and Dreamcast pushes 3 million, but
Yeah.
because you essentially half it because you need two triangles to make a quad kind of thing, you know, so it's like it was more like kind of like 1.5 times more powerful, but there was other things that Model 3 could do in terms of visual effects and graphical things that it could do that Dreamcast quite couldn't. Whereas Naomi, while it is based on the more powerful PowerVR2 graphics chipset, and it does have more VRAM, and I believe it's also got more system RAM, that despite games coming onto Dreamcast, they never looked inferior. Like you look at Crazy Taxi, you look at Virtua Tennis, you know, they're indistinguishable. Like I played Crazy Taxi in the arcade at was, oh, I can't
Arcade
mind.
Club.
Well, that one as well, but recently as well, was I
Oh,
went with my mate
at the
Mark,
bar
the
you
one
went
in
to, yeah.
Glasgow. Yeah. And again, it was and my mate in stitches because like I'm going up to customers and I'm going baseball stadium, Tower Records, Pizza Hut, and he's going, "How the fuck do you know this?" And I'm like, "Cause it's the same. It's like I've played it in the house." So they were to the eye, they were indistinguishable. So it was a smart move in Sega's part, but I would like to maybe do a bit more of a deep dive into just what had the better sheer raw power.
Yeah, and I think something to remember is obviously when Sega were first creating these arcade boards that were, 3D powerhouses, the Model 1, Model 2, Model 3, which all use quads, there wasn't a defined way of rendering 3D at that point. The way that Model 2 actually renders texture maps is very different to your traditional way of doing it. And obviously, 3D moved away from quads, and quads are never used now. It's all triangles. And even though Model 3, in some ways, can do things that Naomi couldn't. Naomi and the Dreamcast themselves were a much more modern design. It's like, for example, if you get like that NVIDIA card, the NVIDIA Titan, and compare that to like a 4060 or something. Obviously, Titan might have more grunt, but the 4060 is the more modern chipset. And while it can't match everything that the Titan does, it might be a bad example because off the top of my head, I don't think the specs are that comparable, but the 4060 could do everything that the Titan does, even though it's a low-end card. It can't do everything, but it does more modern things like dynamic super sampling and all that sort of stuff. So that's the way I thought about it. They're comparable, and the Dreamcast was much more modern and could do extra things because it was more modern. It was a bit like, how the PlayStation could do 3D and the N64, both 3D focused consoles, but they did things completely differently, and pulling one from the other always meant that you had very different results between the two systems. So that's the way I thought about it. And the thing that I found interesting is, obviously, as I said, Model 3, the most powerful arcade board in the world at that time, probably the most powerful games hardware, because even on PC, I don't think that we were just getting into like the likes of Unreal, where PC was catching up.
And
GL
which was,
Quake as well, remember? Open GL yeah.
Quake.
Yeah. And, it's kind of understated how much of a jump it was. Not just having a arcade board that supersedes, and at the time, Naomi was the most powerful arcade board there was. And no disrespect to the Sega STV, the Sega Titan video board, and the Namco System 11, which was PlayStation hardware, which were essentially very much the same premise, i.e., let's consolize our home hardware to make ports easier. But they were very much your budget titles, weren't they? No one was saying, okay, yeah, I'm not going to play Virtua Fighter 2 anymore. I'm going to play Virtua Fighter Kids instead. It was all stuff that was kind of done on a budget, so to speak. Whereas Naomi was the full fat arcade experience. This was Sega's premier arcade board, and not only was it Sega's premier arcade board, but it also translated to their premier home system, which at the time was the most powerful home system in the world. And as we'll get onto a little bit later, it wasn't just Sega that were using this board. So yeah, it was, the way that it was envisioned, the way that it was given to us was, I think, quite remarkable, and isn't something that spoke about quite enough.
The thing you said there about the STV board as well, that was budget titles, and the one that instantly came to mind as well, obviously Virtua Fighter Remix, obviously AM2 along with it was AM1 kind of took that on and kind of reworked it. And again, the praise that Virtua Fighter Remix gets because it's arcade perfect, it's better than the original port. But the original port is based on Model 1, whereas Virtua Fighter Remix is essentially a budget title because it's like they used the Saturn's arcade-based technology to make this game and then kind of ported it back. So you were obviously going to get a more, comparable port,
Yeah.
rather than doing a straight Model 1 port. Is you see it, it looks more detailed in places but more basic in others. I think the it's weird, it's hard to explain, but that calling Virtua Fighter Remix a budget title actually makes sense.
Well,
You know,
it was turned around in a matter of months,
exactly.
on and we're always going to champion the original Sega Saturn port of Virtua Fighter. But Remix, compared to the arcade version, doesn't have as much complex geometry and the character models. Even though it's got texture maps, the character models are simpler. And the way it loses to both the original Sega Saturn port and the Model 1 original is it loses all the lighting effects. So, again, visually and from a hardware perspective, and obviously big champions of the Sega Saturn, but when you're putting that in the arcade, it is obviously a downgrade, not just from Model 1, Model 2, but from Model 1 as well, really. And that's kind of where the Sega STV and the Namco System 11 were coming from. They were not arcade centric boards. They were essentially just home hardware moved over, which was at the time fairly standard for them to be less powerful than the premier arcade boards that were out there. And Naomi effectively changed that, saying, right, we'll base it on home hardware. It will be based almost exactly on Dreamcast hardware, but it will still be the most powerful arcade board that you can get your hands on.
Yeah, I mean, just looking here, I just called up Sega Retro, their kind of spec sheet on it. So Naomi packs twice as much system and graphics memory, four times as much sound memory, a faster power VR2 graphics processor, and faster VRAM bandwidth. And the thing as well that I forgot about, but we'd have probably noticed that we talked about Ferrari F355, is that Naomi boards could be stacked together. You
Yeah.
could have multi boards. Which is what led to the deluxe cabinet of F355, where essentially each Naomi board powered a window on the Ferrari. So very, very clever technology. There's a quote here as well from the VideoLogic CEO from September 1998. With the Sega Dreamcast, Power VR set out to create a new standard in 3D graphics for console gaming. Now, with Sega's Naomi, we will deliver unprecedented levels of 3D performance to arcade systems. So, there you go.
Yeah, and it's unreal what we got, and we're going to talk about a few games later, but so quickly you managed to see the fruits of this. Obviously it was released in 1998 in November, Can't remember the exact date off the top of my head, but pretty close to the Dreamcast. I think the first arcade games came just before the Dreamcast, the first one being F1 World Grand Prix, which I think was an arcade version of the Grand Prix game that obviously we got on the console eventually. And that also came to, is it the same game that came to PS1 and N64, I believe. But then
So,
obviously
got the one I've got here, F1 Grand Prix, the first game that came out, it hit arcades. It's only got, yeah. So, it came out in 1998, but it didn't come to Dreamcast in Japan until 25th of November 1999. So, there was a big gap between that. But you would imagine that would be the case being the first title, because you were still in that kind of period of crossover where you had your kind of Model 3 ports. So, you've still got a lot of Model 3 ports on Dreamcast as well, like your Virtual On. Oratorio Tangram, stuff like that as well. Although there was an Iomi version of that as well, you told me.
Yeah, I've got
So
notes on here, and we'll come on to a couple of those
we
games
will
a little bit
indeed.
later on. But
Yep.
yeah,
Yep.
so F1 World Grand Prix is a weird one because that was the first game, which is kind of an ignominious start, but it's the House of the Dead 2 that came about a week or so later, and that
Yep.
is
Yep.
obviously a big one. And that took what that came out when I got my Dreamcast, which was just a few months later, March 1999. So 4 months it took for the House of the Dead to premiere on the Naomi board and then come home to the Dreamcast. And I do wonder if a lot of the time that it spent to port these was not so much the technical aspect, but rather the fact that obviously when you're creating something for the home, you have to produce it, distribute it, etc., and that might be a factor. But also adding game modes as well may have been a factor, because most Dreamcast games that came home came back with a host of extras: your world tours in Virtua Tennis, your Saturn mode in House of the Dead 2, your original city in Crazy Taxi, all that sort of stuff. So and that stuff takes time to create. I mean, that's a whole other map. That's basically replicating what you did for the first Crazy Taxi, and then doubling up, and then adding the Crazy Box mode, all that sort of
Crazy
stuff.
box,
Virtua Tennis World Tour. That World Tour is absolutely massive, adding all the challenges in there. So, yeah, if you put aside the technical challenges, it probably was creating that extra content. What do you think?
I mean, I think with House of the Dead 2, I think the reason why that jumps out so much as well is because, yeah, it came out in Japanese arcades on 20th of November 1998. And then it came out on Dreamcast on 25th of March 1999. So you've got literally like 4 months between, arcades and Dreamcast debut. But if you think that we just got the Saturn port of House of the Dead in a mid-1998, that was an insane jump. Now, House of the Dead 2 was one of the kind of first games I got again, because also that was like April, early April 99, I got mine, so similar kind of time period to yourself. And I got that in CA Games pretty close to my birthday in kind of May. So, like, again, I was still within a year of having House of the Dead 1 on the Saturn and accepting that it was a compromised port visually, texture work wise, but the gameplay was there. And all of a sudden, you're looking at within 12 months, you've got this thing in your house that looks the exact same as what you've just played at the arcade at the weekend. And it truly was like it was a watershed moment. It really was. I think that is one of the kind of the iconic kind of Dreamcast moments for me, that just seeing that, I just think it was such a statement of intent for where Sega's home hardware was going with arcade. Because as I said, like later on you kind of come to realize, it's not, at the time I remember thinking it was a Model 3 game whenever I seen it in the arcade. It wasn't until later on, whenever you kind of read magazines and stuff, all right, it's based on Naomi. But I think whenever you see that jump in such a short space of time, it was like, oh, this is some capable arcade hardware. And the Dreamcast is going, that's fine, I can just replicate that. And I think that's when you started to realize, despite Sega's initial kind of gusto during the kind of the unveiling phase, where they said, we don't want to stigmatize Dreamcast with arcade ports like Saturn, that they then kind of almost went kind of 180 on it and went, all right, hold on, we'll just base the next arcade board on the Dreamcast, and then it makes arcade ports even easier. So,
It's a, you make such a great point there because the jump was insane. I think the House of the Dead came, must have been April, May 1998. So you're talking, 5 months later, a few days before the Dreamcast launches in Japan, you get the arcade sequel. And obviously, I got House of the Dead on launch. I still got my launch copy on the shelf there. Enjoyed a port despite as flawed as it is. But yeah, and then all of a sudden, you're getting this port. 4 months later, that's arcade perfect, 60 frames per second. All the details of the arcade are there. And not only is it arcade perfect, but that arcade game looks far beyond any other shooters there, any other light gun games that are out there. And it's crazy when you think about where we were at that point. Obviously, we talk about the Saturn, but even if you look at things like the PlayStation, Tekken 3, it's released 1998 as well. I think that was 99 in PAL regions, wasn't it? We didn't get it until the following year, a bit
I
like,
think so.
and good port, atrocious PAL version, really slow, massive borders, rubbish. But, that was a compromised port because it was from the Namco System 23. And obviously, the PlayStation couldn't do that arcade perfect. So it had to, there was cutbacks on there. And it wasn't just the PlayStation. Killer Instinct Gold came out in late 96, 97, maybe in PAL regions. And that was nothing like the arcade game. The arcade game is just so much more visually impressive than Killer Instinct Gold in the N64. And this is not, what, 2 years before the Dreamcast comes out. And the Dreamcast, okay, what, Virtua Fighter 3 TB, a few flaws. It's not an apples to apples comparison because Model 3, Naomi, as we were saying, very different sorts of hardware. It's like porting something from the Saturn to the PlayStation or PlayStation to N64. But you look at what you're getting on the Dreamcast after that, your Power Stone, your House of the Dead 2, arcade perfect games playing without dropping frames, without sacrificing visual fidelity. Even if you look at like looking at Pandemonium's Sega Rally video and seeing how clean the textures are on the arcade version, and even Ridge Race on the PlayStation, how clean that was, and then you get the lower resolution versions when you come to the home for both the PlayStation and Sega Saturn, and then you get these versions of the arcade ports on the Dreamcast, and there's no loss there. It's such an enormous jump, in such a short space of time, and following on for that, I don't think we'd ever see the likes of that sort of jump ever again.
The thing as well, you mentioned next video, the Sega Rally video, which is brilliant, by the way. But both Sega AM3 with mainly with the CS team and the team at Namco who ported Ridge Racer, both of them said that they had to build those games from the ground up. So people call them ports, and it's something that you and I have said a lot on here as well. We don't see them as ports, we see them as new games, but they were built from the ground up because going from the arcade directly to the console wasn't possible. But that was all done away with now with Naomi. Like, because you weren't building games from the ground up because they were the same. Finally, you had parity. They were the same on both sides. So you were taken out. I mean, again, if you look at next video, the timeline of Sega Rally's development, there was a lot of crunch in there. And it was stuck. It went at like 10% to 35%. And for a good few months, it was stuck there. Then it jumped to 55%. And this was over the course of like, because I think, was it February 95? I think they started, I think, if I remember, they said. And they're getting through to the kind of tail end, like October. And they're still at 75%. So they've spent the best part of that year. And they're still at the end, they're having to drop ideas. Like you see them talking about, they've got game modes that they want to add. They wanted to add different cars, possibly more tracks, but all of that had to get, sort of just binned because they were already crunching to try and get in what they got. And yeah, they added Time Attack, they added the kind of the cars that could be tuned and stuff like that, the Stratos, but a lot of the ideas that they wanted to put in were lost. Because they were having to spend that much time reworking the game to bring it across because of differentiating hardware. But like you said earlier, games were coming across from Naomi onto Dreamcast, And because the hardware was the same at both ends, the porting part was a piece of piss. It was like the time that they were probably spending was adding like World Tour mode on Virtua Tennis, like the Crazy Box and Original Cities on Crazy Taxi. So the time was better spent. It wasn't spent trying to cram as much information from the arcade as possible onto the home version. It was like, yep, arcade version's over. But how can we improve this? So that was a key difference.
And there's pros and cons to it, and we could probably talk a little bit more about what it meant for the arcade a little bit later. But I think
Aye.
from a kind of a porting and a standardization perspective, it probably is the start of the homogenization of the industry. Whereas, if you look again at the start, go back to 1994 and you've got Model 1, Model 2, System 22, PlayStation, Sega Saturn, and all this other stuff. And they're all different sorts of hardware. Even obviously you had the STV and you had the System 11, which they were created because of this problem. But you had, I mean, as everyone knows, Saturn hardware wasn't compatible with PlayStation hardware. And we've seen ports go from Saturn to PlayStation that, PlayStation struggled with Saturn games, Saturn struggled with PlayStation games. Model 2 was so much more, it wasn't just more powerful than the Saturn. It was different. That's why it couldn't do the sort of texture maps that the Sega Saturn did, even though it was using sprites to do so. The texture maps on Virtua Fighter 2 on the Sega Saturn give it that little bit of an extra edge that it needed to kind of catch up to the Model 2. And likewise with the PlayStation, it had extra things that it did that allowed it to kind of bridge the gap between its ports. So you've got different hardware doing different things, but all of a sudden, your home hardware and your cutting-edge arcade hardware are exactly the same. And that's, yeah, you don't get that homogenization of the industry then, because now if you go to the modern day, you say, hey, do you know what? Let's make the new Doom. Okay, what are we going to release it on? Everything. Well, how are you going to port it? Well, everything's basically a PC. So we'll make the PC version, and if we want to put it onto PS5, we'll move the graphical sliders here. If we want to put it on Series X, we'll move the graphical sliders here. If we want to put it on Series S, we'll move the graphical sliders down here, and your ports are done. Nintendo Switch 2, we'll move the graphical sliders all the way to the bottom, and we'll have a port that way. So, it's probably from this point that, because of the associated costs of creating the hardware and obviously where arcade games were going, that we start to get that homogenization of the industry where everything starts becoming a little bit familiar. In fact, I think if we talk about the Dreamcast generation, it probably is the last generation where every single console was technologically very different to one another. Because once you get to PS3, Xbox 360, I know we've got the Cell processor. But basically, that was the same processor that the Xbox, the same as the Xenon, because as I remember it, Microsoft hired people from AMD to share the idea, share the blueprints from the Cell, so they could copy them and
Because
expand.
what was it the was the Xbox 360 something to do with power PC, or was it that the graphics chip on it or something like that? It was something to do with
I
power
think so.
PC and the 360. But I mean, that point you made about homogenization as well, again, to quote something from Mizuguchi and Nick's Sega Rally video, and again, it's quite relevant to this as well, because again, they were talking about we're adding things in, but we don't want to add certain things are too much because we still need to give people a reason to play the arcade game, because they still recognize that that was a big, like that was where the money was, in terms of, I think, was it they were saying something about, what was it they say, was it 180 million or something that the Nick
180 million
estimates,
from unit sales, yeah.
from just Sega Rally units. So they clearly had that in mind, that they wanted to make sure that people were still having a reason to play the arcade, which at that point was probably the visuals and the experience of the cabinet. But with, again, Naomi, you were obviously, you didn't have F355's case in the house. You weren't having like a big three screen setup or a steering wheel that was akin to the setup in the arcade, but you were removing the kind of main barrier where, in your eye, your mind's eye, you weren't instantly seeing a difference when you went home.
Yeah.
But I just remember that line as well for the video, that Mizuguchi was very keen to stress we need to make sure people still have a reason to play the arcade. And that, with Dreamcast and Naomi, I think that was lost. People didn't have a reason. Like, if the game looked and played the same in the house, exactly the same in the house as it did in the arcade, that reason was gone.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that probably leads us on to the second point, because this is almost a death knell for arcades. You know, at this point, this is where, and I think arcades were struggling as well. I think it was during our chat with on Editor's Corner with Dave and Mel that Mel said, and he was quite right to say it, you know, arcades were dying a slow death since the late 80s. And, you know, we were enjoying the peaks, but those peaks were literally just keeping it on life support. And once we stopped getting those peaks, it was going. And I think we don't see those again once you get Dreamcast and Naomi. And especially because, you know, in the arcades, you've got the experience. You've got, as you say, the F355, you've got the three screens. Obviously, we wouldn't see anything quite like that on the Dreamcast, but you got your Ferrari race reel, you got your Get Bass fishing rod, you got your Sanma Park official fighting stick. You got all sorts of those peripherals coming into your Samba de Amigo Ram Maracas.
Maracas.
You know, you got everything in the home, and all of a sudden, your reasons for going, even that novelty factor, is getting diminished because of the existence of, you know, I can play this at home. And obviously, at the time, you know, I was like, seeing all these arcade games, seeing Virtua Tennis, this looks just like real life. I'm going to be able to play this at home. What's this? A big old truck game. I'm going to be able to play that at home soon. and you don't think, you know, by me playing these at home and not putting my quid in the machine, I'm probably contributing to the death of the arcade.
You think of how many times you press start on that Dreamcast controller. Every time you press start, that was a quid less that Sega were making, because, you know, you didn't have to go down there and like take a tenner's worth of change and kind of decide, oh, I need to budget, what am I going to put my money in this week? Who's going to be the lucky recipient of £2 coins this week? You know, you can just play them in the house, swap a disc and get the same experience and play it over and over and over again. And you're getting extra features, extra modes. You know, you're finally moving away from the criticism that was leveled at not just Saturn arcade ports, but PlayStation arcade ports. Some of them had the same, you know, as well, where there wasn't quite enough extra. Like the Tekken games tend to do, like Tekken Bowl and Tekken Force Mode and stuff like that, gimmicky, but it did enough to pacify the critics who wanted to see more than the arcade port.
Yeah.
But, you know, you were getting on Dreamcast, you were basically getting all this extra stuff. And those criticisms were removed, you know, that were in Saturn and PlayStation ports, where, like, look at Manx TT on Saturn, like the most bare bones arcade port ever. You were totally moving away from that with Naomi and Dreamcast.
Yeah, with whole new content. I mean, I was going to just say just now, until about 2010, I was still judging my value for money on how many times I was playing a game. Like, how many goes does this cost? My favorite, I think it ended when I'm in my infatuation with Street Fighter 4, when I ranked up something like 4,000, 5,000 games online. And I was like, yeah, quid a go. Definitely definitely got my money's worth out of this one. I couldn't play that much in the arcade.
No, I need a loan or something, a student loan or something at that point, mate. And be like, phone up Newcastle, taking a course extension, you know, the loan, please. Let me play some more Street Fighter 4. 5,000 credits, please.
Yeah. But yeah, it's it was insane how much extra we were actually getting. And, you know, it's coming back to that quote, yeah, you were getting less and less reasons to go back to the arcade. But on the ports themselves, you've mentioned Crazy Taxi earlier. And I've never really noticed the difference between the two. Obviously, Dreamcast hardware wasn't quite on the par with the Naomi. Naomi, as you were saying, faster bus, more RAM, more VRAM. But it wasn't really reflected in the ports, was it? There was nothing that was obvious in terms of visual downgrades.
See, part of me thinks that's because, again, Naomi wasn't being pushed. At that point, I don't think it was being pushed to its limits. I don't even know if it ever was really pushed to its limits before Naomi 2 came along.
Yeah.
But, I mean, stuff that you look at, that kind of run of games, you know, you've got Power Stone, Crazy Taxi, Zombie Revenge, Virtua Striker 2, just kind of Dead or Alive 2, obviously Tecmo, Outrigger, Virtua Tennis, 18 Wheeler. So those games all kind of obviously Dreamcast games. And looking at them, they're all, like for like. So the quality of the ports wasn't diminished at all, but was that made easier because the vision that, Sega, Capcom, etc. had for these games, was there just enough in Naomi to do what they wanted? And then basically, why use all that grunt, if it's not necessary? Because like stuff like Power Stone as well, you look at the attention to detail in the stages. You look at like Falcon or Fokker, you look at his stage, like the Lundo or London stage, and it's beautiful, the cobbled streets and the fountain in the middle, the little signs outside the cafes and restaurants, stuff like that. Just you can see the little kind of writing and all that, on them when you pick it up and throw it to somebody. But it's just the level of detail is astounding. The kind of costumes and the characters as well, the detail on their clothing, everything about it was on the arcade version was carried across. But at that point in time, there'd be no real need for them to go crazy. So I think that helped as well, that the Dreamcast ports weren't having to emulate full-blown, full-spec, push-to-the-limits Naomi games.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a combination of factors there. I mean, one factor is I don't think we actually ever saw the Dreamcast push to the absolute limit. It took
Which
us.
is tragic, absolutely tragic. There's
It was.
power in that box we've never seen, and we never will see, I
Exactly.
don't think.
When you first look at the PlayStation 2 and what that produced in 2000, no way would you think that a game like God of War was possible in it, because God of War is an absolutely phenomenal looking game on hardware, absolutely sensational. And I know Metal Gear Solid that came out in 2001 is great looking as well, but God of War is just the scale and everything in that. You wouldn't have thought that the PlayStation was capable of that. And the Dreamcast never had that moment. It had Shenmue 2, which gave us maybe a hint of what might have been possible, but we never saw the title that pushed it to its limit. And maybe that is part of the reason why we never saw compromised Naomi games. We didn't see Naomi push to its limit, much like we didn't see the Dreamcast push to its limit. Games like, obviously, Power Stone's very impressive because everything's so detailed. You've got very crisp textures, very detailed textures in there. But in terms of actual, visual fidelity and detail, they are quite small diorama stages, aren't they? They're little box outs, they're not huge arenas. The characters, you can see kind of their joins and their limbs and everything. As detailed as they are, visually amazing at the time, but you kind of look at something that came out after, like Dead or Alive 2, which you probably could get that sort of visual fidelity on a character level in a Power Stone stage when it comes a little bit later. Games like Zombie Revenge absolutely not pushing the Dreamcast to its absolute limit, because
No.
that game looks like a Model 2 game almost, because it looks like a lot like Dynamite Cop or Dynamite Decker 2 in the way that the because
Dynamite
that.
Decker 2 still looks better than it. Again, those are two games that are on the Naomi video that I did, and like the Zombie Revenge was the one that actually made me go, ooh, like that looks rough in places,
It
like
does.
really rough.
Yeah, it feels a bit rough and ready, doesn't it? And yeah, I think it's games like that that you don't see. The only game that really I think you really pushed the hardware, and not because it was pushing any kind of the Naomi board itself, but because of the makeup of it, was Ferrari F355. And that was because, as you said earlier, it was multiple Dreamcast, multiple Naomis all hooked up together to give you the three screens and the control Naomi board in the middle. So yeah, I think it was a case that they didn't get to push the hardware. And possibly also, I don't know how much developers, obviously it wasn't just Sega getting onto these, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but it wasn't just Sega using this. Now, there was Matt McMuscles did a video on Street Fighter 3 in a one of his What Happened series, and he was talking about how at the time, this is late 96, Capcom, and maybe even 98 when Third Strike is coming out, Capcom are still pushing to deliver games in the arcade and not focusing on the home. Their bread and butter is the arcade, so they're focusing on Street Fighter 3. Resident Evil sold 3 million, but we don't care about that. How many Street Fighter 3 arcade boards have we sold? So you wonder, was there a switch at that point? Were they still looking like that? And would they have still been inclined to push arcade games? Or would they have thought, right, a home is now where the money is. Let's make these games for the home first, port the bare bones version to the arcade, and then finish off the home version after. What I wonder if that was an approach that they had at that point. Because something like Power Stone, I can sort of think him saying, right, we've done the arcade mode, stick that in the arcade, now let's do the extra.
Even you look at like Power Stone 2 as well. Like I know I'm not sure if they are. I've never played Power Stone 2 in the arcade. Even if Power Stone 2 ever was an arcade game, if that was a straight to home version,
You
I'm
know
not
what?
sure if
I'm not
Power Stone.
sure.
I don't see Power Stone 2 on the actual list of releases, so unless I've missed it, so I think that might have been a straight to home port, you know. But if you look at that as well, that tried to it gave you the kind of the four player party style game, but it still harked back to the original game where you know you could have a 1v1 on a smaller, more condensed stage. Not a massive fan of Power Stone 2. I think it just loses all. It's confused what it wants to be. It wants to be Power Stone, but it wants to be Smash Brothers. It's like, it's just, it loses it. It's too short. It's mid-game boss is a joke, and the final boss is an idiot. Just, I'm not a fan of it at all. But that point you made about, like, Dreamcast not being pushed to its potential, like you mentioned, like Shenmue 2, and I think Shenmue 2 is, like, the kind of the crowning moment for Dreamcast visually. And in terms of scale, like the like Kowloon just is ridiculously detailed, but it's like, and I know some people say like Shenmue 2 is Dreamcast being pushed to its limits, but it was like 3 years and whenever it was discontinued, and you brought up like the comparison of like God of War on PS2. For me, the kind of game that made me sit up and think, holy shit, about PlayStation 2 was Gran Turismo 3. That was the game that made me go, all right, okay, this is showing some serious grunt. But I like you look at Dreamcast and you think, if it was given like the full 5, 6 years, if developers had got to know all the little kind of nips and tucks and tweaks, and you know, as it happens with every console, you think look at what comes out in year one, year three, and year five. There's a marked difference between them. And we just never got to see that because, like I've always said, like I know Virtua Fighter 4 is an iOmi 2 game, right? But I look at that PlayStation 2 port and it's so dull. Like the colors just don't pop on it at all. There's jaggies on there. And I'm thinking, you know, Dreamcast could have done that. If that's in year five or whatever. You know, Dreamcast could have done that with all the kind of nips and tucks that are in there. So that's the one massive regret I've got about Dreamcast. There's a little box under our TV, and we'll never get to see what that metal in that box can actually do. It's kind of sad.
At the time I recorded, I'm working on a PS2 video, and Virtua Fighter 4 is one of the games I feature on it. And it's a great port on PlayStation. Obviously, there's nips and tucks. Would a Sega Dreamcast port have been any better? Well, the flaws that you see in the PlayStation 2 port are obviously you lose a lot of the character detail, a lot of the stage detail. Textures are a little bit muddy on the PlayStation 2, lower resolution. And then you've got your jaggies, and then you've got a vastly different color palette. It looks so dull on PlayStation 2. And I don't know what the Dreamcast could have done about the other three. You know, probably would have had to have lower resolution textures, probably would have lost a lot of detail, like geometry, etc. But the color palette and the anti-aliasing, I think it probably would have been a cleaner image. Whether it would have, how close it could have got to the arcade or PlayStation 2 versions in terms of the other parts, we'll never know. But and it's a shame that we will never know how close it could have got. But there we
A
go.
what if moment, mate. A what if moment.
Oh, Sega
Yeah,
are full of them. But yeah, I mean, okay, it's funny we talk about games that were arcade perfect. And then you had the two games that I've got on here, and I'm sure there are others. But Virtua Fighter 2, or Vir sorry, not Virtua Fighter, Virtua Striker 2 version 2000.1 came to the home but that was a port of a Naomi port of the Model 3 game. And it's funny that the Naomi game is called an upgrade, which is the same which can be said for Virtuon Oratorio Tangram. And I can't remember what those upgrades are called because they're called something bizarre, like version B 0.55378 octagon, whatever. But these are two games where, when you're talking about Naomi versus Model 3, these are updates and upgrades to those two games based on Dreamcast hardware that have gone into the arcade. And I think they are viewed as the definitive versions now.
Yeah, it's similar to FD55 Challenge 2, which is basically the Dreamcast game ported back to Naomi, because the Dreamcast port of the original FD55 added extra tracks and other modes. So Sega went, we'll take that and we'll give that to the arcade and call that the sequel. It's like, and just checking, by the way, Power Stone 2 did come out in the arcade. But here's a, not to sound like Nick, fun fact. It came out in the arcade and Dreamcast in the same month.
Fun fact.
Fun fact, April 2000, and now on Naomi in the arcade, and it came out at the very end of April on the 27th of the month on Dreamcast, and it was then released in the US just 4 months later in August. So we're talking about those quick turnaround times
That
as a
might be
prime
the fastest.
example. That might
That
be, mate.
might.
That's ridiculous.
So we've talked about the origin of Naomi. We've talked about what it is, what it could do, and what it meant for ports coming home. We talked about the Model 3 ports that got upgraded and re-released in Naomi, and games that went to Naomi, went to Dreamcast, then went back to. It's the chicken and the egg, isn't
We came
it?
first.
Yeah. But it wasn't just Sega using this hardware, which again shows what it was capable of, because as we said, it was the most capable hardware on the market at the time. And
Yeah.
the two biggest users of it were Sega's arcade rivals, Namco and Capcom.
See, they knew where the goodness was eventually, mate. They knew where the bread was buttered. I mean, Cap, looking at the games, like Capcom definitely gave us the better. Like Namco's, like the one that kind of stands out the most is Gun Survivor 2, the kind of Code Veronica shooter. The rest are, which again distributed by Namco, but it's a Capcom game franchise,
Yeah, bizarre that, isn't it?
yeah. So, like as if Namco were, we need some need something decent because we've got Shin Nihon Pro Wrestling Tukon Rich Suden Arcade Edition. We've got
Yeah,
Ninja Assault, World Kicks, and Mazan Flash of the Blade. That's
yeah.
Namco.
Yeah, well, Namco had the they had the I think Ninja Assault was what they was coded by them, and I think it also came to the PlayStation 2, didn't it? Ninja Assault, I think. Obviously, Gun Survivor 2 also came to it was ported somewhere. I think the Gun Survivor was ported to the PS2 as well.
That I'm sure I was. I remember buying that. I'm sure I remember getting that. That's definitely in PlayStation 2. And I
Yeah.
had a Resident Evil shooter on PlayStation 2 anyway.
Yeah, and but it was Capcom that were kind of the other MVP, wasn't it? And the sheer amount of games that they released for the Naomi is pretty staggering. And it's kind of like a Power Stone 2, Spawn, Gun Spike or Cannon Spike, Capcom versus SNK 1 and 2, Giga Wing 2, Marvel versus Capcom 2, Project Justice, Heavy Metal Geomatrix. It's just an obscene selection of games there. It's almost like a greatest hits almost, and you look at that and you just
Aye.
think, oh, what
Capcom,
an idol.
though, I mean, they solidified that relationship with Champion Edition, Street Fighter 2 Special Champion Edition on the Mega Drive. And from there on, like Capcom with Sega during that era, Saturn and Dreamcast were just absolute MVPs when it came to, as a third party. I mean, Marvel versus Capcom 2 and the two Capcom versus SNK games, I've been playing a fair bit of Capcom versus SNK2 for a video I was doing, and oh, it's just such a good game. Like the depth to it, the groove systems, it's astounding that the sheer volume of characters that are in that game are ridiculous. Like, I'm glad there's not a timer on the select scene for picking a character, and if there is, it must be really long, because like moving that little arrow to go and look through it to find out who you're looking for is just it's insane. Spawn, I think, is quite underrated. It's actually a quite a good bit of fun.
Yeah, it's
I do
quite
like
challenging.
Spawn and the Demon's Hand, brilliant,
Yeah.
brilliant game. I Project Justice as well, Rival Schools 2. Another one featured in the video recently, just brilliant again, expanding on the kind of 1997 original, expanding the team lineup, adding that story mode with that beautiful kind of anime kind of cutscenes. You can have story mode or arcade mode, again, expanding on that arcade experience. So just Capcom, just really, obviously, the two Power Stone games as well, but just that there is some of Capcom's best work ever
Yeah.
in the arcade. And again, it's running on Sega hardware.
Yeah. Really allowed them to do, some pretty special stuff. And it's interesting because I remember reading the Sega Saturn magazine in 1998, and there was a big 2-4 page interview, I think. And they're talking about Resident Evil 2 port, talking about whether they could use the 4 megabyte RAM cart to bring Resident Evil 2, and they were saying no, it's not an issue with RAM. And then they were talking about the Dreamcast specs because it had just been revealed, and they're saying we're not sure if the 2D specifications are up to our standards yet. But then you see the games that came after, and you think we're pretty much there. Because even I don't know if it's listed on there actually, but Street Fighter 03 also got a port to Naomi. I don't think it's on here, is it? Yeah, but
I see it.
Street Fighter 03 Upper was a Naomi game.
Ah, right, okay.
Again, one of these snake eating itself. The original, Capcom, was it CPS2 arcade game for Street Fighter 03, was ported to a number of systems, one of them the Dreamcast, but the Dreamcast infamously retooled, rebalanced, took out a lot of the bugs, toned down, nerfed Viism, changed a load of the hitboxes, etc. So it plays like quite a different game. But obviously, the base arcade version didn't have the extra characters like Fei Long, DJ, etc., who were in the home ports, or Guile. So then, after Capcom ported the game to the Dreamcast, they brought it back in to the arcade on the Naomi board of Street Fighter Alpha 3 Upper. And I think that version, I believe, supports you using your VMU.
Ah, right, okay. I mean, another one, you talk about another company, and again, with deep roots to Sega, is Tecmo. And we could have touched on Dead or Alive 2 earlier, but Tecmo were saved as a company because of the use of the Model 2, obviously bringing Dead or Alive to life. And then again, using Sega hardware in Naomi to power the sequel. So, just again, these kind of ties, you just look at all these like kind of little threads that go back through kind of history. Obviously, like Capcom, with, as we said, with the Street Fighter 2 Champion Edition, that
Yeah.
building that relationship with Sega, and then Tecmo being saved by using Sega hardware. And then, I mean, Dead or Alive 2 is on Dreamcast, it's absolutely stunning. I know we got the limited edition in Japan, and then we got was it Millennium Edition or something? It was called the PlayStation 2. Was it the Dead or Alive 2 Ultimate or something like that
That's it,
that we
yeah.
got? But it added kind of like flashy kind of hitbox lighting effects, but visually it was very, very jaggy. But it did add a lot of extra costumes and a lot of extra stages. Now, the Japanese limited edition version on the Dreamcast doesn't bring over all the extra stages and costumes. It has some extra costumes. I think the US port of Dead or Alive 2 has actually got more extra costumes than the original version and the limited edition Japanese version. But the limited edition Japanese version brings back two stages from the first Dead or Alive.
Yeah.
So there's, again, just different mismatch of different kind of features. But like, just Dead or Alive 2, I think, I know Soul Calibur gets a lot of praise for how it looks, but I think Dead or Alive 2 runs it damn close, and in some places it actually surpasses it. Some of the stage work is astounding, like the kind of level that you start with, a kind of like a rooftop, and you can either batter them through the fence and off the edge, or there's a kind of reddish, kind of burgundy, kind of wooden wall with little kind of cross hatch windows. If you smash them through that, you fall away into a room that's got a big golden dragon. It's absolutely stunning. So I mean, Tecmo didn't do a lot of work with the Naomi, but the one that they did, just followed on from that kind of relationship that they built, because Sega essentially saved them by giving them that Model 2 technology to make Dead or Alive.
Yeah, no, absolutely right, mate. I think Dead or Alive 2 is the more visually impressive out of that and Soul Calibur. I mean, purely Soul Calibur. I think the characters are a lot more simple. Obviously, they're ports of System 23 character models. They've been beefed up, but they are still pretty. You can see that there's the extra detail there, and they look great. But you can see their origins betrays them a bit. Whereas Dead or Alive 2, I think everything looks a lot cleaner. And the same with the stages. Dead or Alive 2, a lot more elaborate, a lot more geometry in there. They're fully 3D. Whereas, I remember looking at stuff like I was looking at Killy's stage, or if you're looking at Sophitia's stage, and you're looking at, oh, that mountain over there, or even Mitsurugi's temple that's in the background, but they're not fully 3D. They're 2D images, cleverly displayed looking 3D, but they're not fully 3D. Whereas Dead or Alive 2 does, you're interacting with the scenery, battering someone against the wall, kicking them through a window and stuff. I think it is the better game. But yeah, Tecmo, Arc System works with the Guilty Gear game. Guilty Gear X came on there. Again, a stunning game. Again, it feels like that sort of high detail, high contrast look was made for Dreamcast and Naomi. And obviously that was the game that really kicked that series into gear. No pun intended.
Oh, boom.
But yeah, that was the basis for what we'd see with Guilty Gear X, and then Guilty Gear X would get all its updates, and then you get Guilty Gear XX, which was that got all the updates. Where you get Guilty Gear XX Plus Alpha, Accent Core Plus Plus, or whatever it's called. Then you have Guilty Gear Xrd. So yeah, there's loads of others that we could get into, but they were all utilizing the Naomi board. And even when Sega had moved on to Hikari and Naomi, the Naomi 2, there was still games being developed for it all the way up until 2009 by different software houses. So it really was something that was very heavily utilized across the board.
And the other one I wanted to mention as well is from Taito, which is and I'm going to bring it up because Derek Pascarell has actually done a translation patch for it recently, and that's Trezile, which is a really nice little shooter, quite kind of retro looking in places, or retro for that time. It kind of harks back to, the kind of the more traditional old school, shmups, but it's lovely. And again, he's done extra little kind of tweaks on there as well, kind of quality of life improvements, fixing the kind of boundaries of the text, how it's displayed, things like that as well. So that's a brilliant translation and kind of quality of life improvement patch he's done. So if you've not tried that one out, you've got a GDMU or a mod, certainly recommend it, because I had a blast playing it.
Yeah, it's one. Do you know, it's one that I've never actually put some time into. So I think now that Derek's done the work on there, and what I love, at the time of recording, I've just done the Blast Wind
Last
video,
ones, yep.
and that's got loads of quality of life. So these guys always just go above and beyond just the translation, don't they? It's a, we get all the extra stuff as well. But mate, let's talk about a few games. I think, mate, we've got a couple each, and we won't go into too much detail, because obviously we talked a lot about the console and about the board already. But I think we'll go one each and go for. I think you picked four, and I've got four. So just pick a few favourites of ours. What was the first one you got on your list?
The first one on my list, mate, was Crazy Taxi,
Of
and
course.
I mean, it's my go-to when it comes to Dreamcast, really, isn't it? I mean, I've spoken, so many times about Crazy Taxi on this show. I just think it epitomizes the Dreamcast, it epitomizes that era. so perfectly. I think the soundtrack, the vibe, the brands that are in it, you know, they're just so synonymous. There's brands there that aren't in existence anymore, like Tower Records, you know, stuff like that. Brands that you don't really hear about anymore in the UK, like Fila. You know, it's rooted. It's I called it in a video I did previously, I called it a gaming time capsule, because
Yes,
I just
accurate.
feel as if every time you boot it up, you're just transported back to like that 2000, 2001 kind of era. Everything about it is absolutely perfect. The gameplay is simple, it's addictive, it's got that classic Sega hook where you can pick it up and play it and you'll have fun. But if you learn it, if you really dig deep into the controls, master those little kind of the crazy throws, limit cuts, you know, you're drifting, all that kind of stuff. That the crazy box is kind of, it's they're all bonus games, but they exist to train you how to use these moves. It's very clever. They've kind of turned the training, it's almost like a tutorial that's not a tutorial. It's like, you know, like crazy drift. You learn how to crazy drift by popping the balloon or the balls, the balloons. You learn, you know, how to do your limit cuts and things like that by having to boost fast enough to jump off the edge and go as far as possible. So, you know, it's very, very clever. But I just think it epitomizes Dreamcast perfectly. It just captures the essence of that era to an absolute T. So that's why I picked that as my first one.
Yeah, it's cracking. I mean, I was playing it earlier, albeit on the PlayStation 2. And even though that's a horrible port, it's still, you know, the quality of the game still shines through on there. Still, yeah, so still enjoying my time apart from on that original city, which I hated. But
That
but yeah, I
is
think
not great.
I think we'd be disappointed if you didn't mention, but Crazy Taxi 2, mate, and I think some of mine will probably be predictable as well. But the first one I'm gonna go for is House of the Dead 2. The game I got with my Sega Dreamcast when I bought it in March 1999, bought with the gun, you know, the game that's, you know, it sold that arcade perfect in the home. And I know we'd had a few games before, like Power Stone came out a month before, but House of the Dead 2 really was, you know, a premiere looking game that looked better than most things that you'd seen on the market at that point. Superb fun. I don't think it is quite as tight, and I don't think the atmosphere is as good as the very first game. But everything else it does, it's fantastic. A lot bigger. I think the last two stages feel a bit rushed. We've got the car. You're in the car and you do the bus rush, and then you're in the lab at the end, and it feels quite unimaginative in that you're fighting the enemies and they're literally just grey versions of the things you've killed already. But still, I mean, I'm nitpicking. It's an absolutely phenomenal light gun game. One of the best ever, and I think a lot of people do say this is their favorite light gun game of all time, and rightly so. It's an absolutely fantastic game. We played this in arcade club as well, didn't we?
We
Albeit
did,
the
yeah.
light guns had a few issues with them. I think we had to keep them pressed up against the glass, but
I think I almost put my light gun through the glass. I didn't realize the glass was quite that close, because it was the CRT was sunk right inside the machines, and they had that kind of the glass coming over, and we were standing at normal distance, weren't we? We were like, these aren't hitting anything. We were like right up at it. Now it's working. Brilliant
It's
game. Love it.
brilliant. Yeah, great visuals, great soundtrack, superb gameplay, great bosses. I mean, even the first boss is so clever. You have to shoot the little goblin thing that's flying around. I can't remember his
Pain
name.
in the ass. Aye. It's a
Yeah,
several action dots. No, come. It's like that voice. Just seems like my advice had no effect. Up, you wee purple goblin.
it's you know, having to shoot him because he's controlling the big suit of armor that's invulnerable is pretty cool. And then he had the Hydra, you have to shoot all the different heads off it.
Oh, that was. I see the first time I seen that on the Dreamcast, that blew me away. Like, because obviously it roars, the one that's going to hit you next, it roars and its mouth lights up, and you, oh, good, that one. And the, is it the second stage? The big lizard thing that
The second
gives it
stage,
all
yeah,
that.
does a little dance.
It's got the spear in it, and its chest kind of opens up like that, as if it's, you've got to try and hit the, oh,
Then you got
crazy.
the madman with the chainsaw on the at the end of the fourth one. He's always holding it right in front of his face and just unloading clips at his chainsaw until he drops it.
Aye. Memorable though, mate. We're still recalling it
Yeah.
all these years later,
And that's
so
what I'm
it
saying.
did
I'm saying they
something.
were great bosses, and the route selection in that one was massive as well. So yeah,
Yes, aye.
much grander in scope than the first game. As I say, not as good from not as tight, and not the atmosphere wasn't as good for me, but everything else just one of the greatest light gun games of all time. So back to you, mate. Another Naomi
One that
here.
we've also touched on it briefly, Virtua Tennis. You know, Virtua Tennis as the title screen likes to scream at you. But picked this one because the arcade game on its own is superb. And I know people mock the kind of the sunken zombie eyes on the characters. And I know in the second game, I think they kind of fixed the look. The characters are very chunky.
Yeah.
You know, and they're very stocky. You know, like Tim Henman is not that buff, right? It's like Tim Henman is like that, right? But in this, he's like a. But you know, they fixed that in the second game where they look a lot more like athletes and the animation's a lot better. But I picked the first game over the sequel, just because of that. I don't think tennis games had quite hit that level of realism. Like you had stuff like your Super Tennis and stuff like that in the Super Nintendo, which got a lot of praise. It was a lot of fun. But this, if you watch the sport, and I can't play tennis to save my life, but I'll always watch the slams, and I have done, God, since my teens, and been able to recognize like Flushing Meadow, Roland Garros, Wimbledon, just the wee like attentions to detail. Because like obviously, as you go through each stage, that's meant to be the final. So the fact that they know whenever you go to Wimbledon that the baselines are eroded because of 2 weeks worth of people shuffling along them, just little details like that, you know, that show that they cared enough to look at these things and put that in there, knowing that fans of the sport would notice that. But the shot variation, the physics, like if you play that on the default or harder, some of the rallies you can get are phenomenal. Like you'll be smacking like forehands down the line, and Jim Courier at the age of like at that point, that game must have been like mid-30s, is flying through there like Superman and firing it back at you. And it's like it's incredible, you know. And I know if you lob it up in the air, or you know, you can smash it and they've not got a chance. But even on like the clay court, and even on like the kind of like Flushing Meadows, the kind of indoor courts, the ball leaves little marks on the surface. So like, don't need Hawkeye. You can't dispute if the shot was in. It was in. It's like no, you can see if it was in or out. Just little kind of like the umpire watching the play. You know, you can slice shots, you can lob shots, you can forehand, backhand. You position your player. You know yourself if you run with the analog stick to the left. I picked Tommy Haas because he's got that really strong forehand. So if you're holding the analog stick to the left to run to a shot, but then you hold A and then like start moving the stick back to the right, you're it sends it into a cross court forehand that just rips into the far corner. It's like even like return and serve. Like I always like to kind of like keep my wee guy dancing along his corner at the baseline, move forward 2 steps, and then hold A and then diagonally down towards the opposite corner. Mate, that return's coming back at you into the opposite corner. It's so well done. It mixes the perfect blend of realism with Sega arcade gameplay. And well, the second game added again a world tour mode that let you train a male and a female tennis player. You could compete in mixed doubles and solo matches. Again, the first game, I think, just for what it did at the time, it did it. It's more iconic to me. So that's why I picked Virtua Tennis 1.
Yeah, that's another one. I think you can't talk about Naomi without talking about Virtual Tennis. As I say, I didn't really notice the sunken eyes when I first saw it. When I first saw it, I saw a small telly in our bowling alley, and I thought that the full small monitor that the arcade game was playing, and I thought it was a live game from a
There you go.
distance. It was that much of a jump, but yeah, just simply incredible, mate. Next one for me, another stalwart Ferrari F355. I got to play this one in the Trocadero in wasn't Sega World at that time, but it was, you know, we still had the floors of arcade games, and Ferrari F355 Challenge was in there with the big full screen, free screen version. It was £2 a go. So I had two goes in there, spent, you know, £4. The first one trying to play it like an arcade game and crashing into everything, and the second go a lot more measured. And yeah, what I love about that is it's just quite like anything, unlike anything else that was around at the time. And even now, your Gran Turismos and Forza Motorsports are a lot more forgiving than this game was. This game was really, you know, a proper simulation, more like something that you probably see in what a Assetto Corsa or something like that. And even then, it was like the attention to detail was incredible, and it was just such a visually striking game. Obviously, you didn't have the car variety. You were in your F355, racing against another bunch of F355 cars, but they were all so detailed. It wasn't like, you know, you look at your rival cars in, I'm probably talking generation before, like Sega Rally and Daytona, where they're all quite basic looking. Obviously, when you get to Sega Rally 2, I think it was all the other different cars that you weren't playing as were your rivals. But even then, you know, every car is as detailed as yours. The tracks all look so realistic. It was just an absolutely stunning game, beautiful to play, and just obviously unforgiving, required so much. And even when you played it at home, you still had to really grind to get good at it. But as an arcade game, it was such an experience, probably the closest a lot of people would ever get to driving an actual real Ferrari. So, and again, I mean, last week when we were recording, we were talking about Yu Suzuki, and it was all about giving gamers those experiences. And that's exactly what F355 did. It was a game, a very challenging game, a very deep game, but it was also an experience for the players. A stunning looking, beautifully sounding, the car sound spot on, great soundtrack. And it was, but overall, it was just an experience that, you know, paying £2 to drive a Ferrari by proxy, it's not too bad, is it?
Yeah, man, it's Alan J, the voice. Tuning. Brilliant, man. Soundtrack is incredible.
Is. What about you, mate? What's your next one?
Next one I've went for might surprise people, but I've got a soft spot for it. It's 18-wheeler. Out of my way, Greenhorn.
I've really fallen in love with this one again recently. But go on, mate. What makes it? Oh, obviously, you've got your video, which everyone should be checking out. Put a little thing up
Yeah,
somewhere.
I've got a cowboy hat on in the thumbnail. It's
Yeah,
took some brass neck to actually do that, by the way, I'm telling you. So you call putting yourself out there. But no, I just think it gets a lot of stick, I think, because it doesn't do anything kind of major in terms of beyond the basic arcade port, but it's just ridiculous fun. And again, it's got that kind of, very clever Sega score attack kind of mechanic on it. It's devilishly unforgiving, even on the easiest setting on Dreamcast. It is punishing. Like, if you decide to ignore those little cars that have got the time above them to add on to your counter, you ain't making it. But you score more by taking less damage to your rig, so you've got to balance, like driving more conservatively. But then obviously, Lizard Tail comes across and he will want to hit you. He'll put obstacles in your path. He'll send debris in front of you. He'll berate you. He'll try and put you off. So you've got to kind of try and get ahead of him. But if you drive recklessly enough to get ahead of him, which gets you a bonus, but you might take damage to your cargo, which knocks your score down. So there's this kind of risk versus rewards mechanic going on there, which is quite clever. But I just, the arcade version is incredible fun. Like, again, we played it at an arcade club and it was only the stand-up cab, but even that had the big wheel on
I
it.
was going to say,
And it was so loose, and but it was responsive, but it was obviously meant to mimic that whole, like, this
yeah.
turntable-sized steering wheel that you're firing around.
Yeah.
But such great fun. The bonus stages, again, testing your parking skills, which has got, if the first one has got they give you upgrades, obviously, if
Yeah.
you, and the first one is cracks everyone up, you got the horn. It's like, well, that's for another show. But it's just, there's so much personality to it. The arcade version, I believe the person voicing Lizard Tail was the same person who did BD Joe in Crazy Taxi, but it was redone for the Dreamcast version. And actually, it's like he sounds better in the Dreamcast version than he does in the arcades. He sounds more kind of almost parody, like condescendingly, kind of just total cheek. Like, I got a parking ticket and I got a speeding ticket and it was all your fault. And it's like he just talks absolute garbage, but it's you kind of have these moments where you're just chuckling away. The Dreamcast port is absolutely nailed on. The kind of later tracks that you take part in, the kind of routes you go up through mountains, there's boulders that come rolling down the hill towards you. You've got to dodge them, so it throws you some curveballs, but it's a ton of fun, and that's why I picked it to highlight it on this one.
Yeah, it's an absolutely sensational game, and there's so much to it. There really is. You've got the alternative routes that you can choose, and they'll take you through the stage quicker and give you a better chance of getting, towards the end of the stage, but they're a lot more difficult. Like the one where you're on the second stage, if you go right, you go and you're coming onto the gravel and you're losing speed already, and you have to barge through those barns, and you definitely have to hit the cars
Oh,
on that bit. If you stay on the asphalt and go down the freeway on that one, it's longer, so again it's quite challenging, but it's the risk versus reward as well, because you can get a slipstream if you sit behind Lizard Tail or kind of buses and other trucks, but you can't if you sit behind the cars. If you hit the back of a car, you'll lose a bit of speed and the car will go flying. But if you hit another big vehicle, which are the only ones you can slipstream behind, then you lose a lot of speed, and obviously that'll just bounce off you. So, yeah, it's fantastic. I was playing the PlayStation 2 port a lot recently for a video, and PlayStation 2 port is it loses, it's interlaced, it doesn't look as good. The use of lighting's not as good, and there's a few lost details, but overall, they're kind of nitpicks. It's nowhere near as bad as the Crazy Taxi port 2 port is, and it actually loads a bit faster. I played the Dreamcast version on my GDEMU, and that's my go-to, but for a version to own, that was £1.50 in CEX, the PS2 port. So
Wow.
it's a great little version. And whatever you play it on, whether it's Dreamcast, PS2 or GameCube version's not bad either. It's just a brilliant game, and as you were saying, mate, it's fantastic in the arcade with your great big wheel. It really does feel like you're sitting in the cockpit of Optimus Prime.
Oh, superb, mate. Superb. We
So my next
shows.
one, is going to surprise absolutely no one. It is the original Capcom versus SNK, and this wasn't a game to me. This was an event. As someone at the time, this is 1999 when this first came out, the tail end of 99. I'd been playing Street Fighter for years. I was obsessed with it in 92, 93. Continued playing 2D fighters through all the way through the Sega Saturn's life. Obviously, X-Men versus Street Fighter, a big driver for me to get my Sega Saturn modified to play Japanese games. And of course, I was the one reading that Capcom interview where they're talking about the 2D performance, going, "Oh no, please. You got to make more 2D games for the Sega Dreamcast. 3D is great, but I want my classic 2D fighters." And of course, as well as being a Capcom fan, as I've said on the show many times, I was really into my SNK in the Saturn era, loving the Fatal Fury games, more specifically, I love the King of Fighters games. And even though Capcom versus SNK, on a base level, there's definite downgrades compared to the sequel. The roster's nowhere near as big. It's actually quite restricted because it is pretty much just King of Fighters 95 or 94 versus the Super Street Fighter 2 team, with maybe a character here or there on either side. Like you've got Morrigan on the Capcom side and trying to remember on the SNK side. But overall, it's just like those two 94 games. But it's just done so well. You've got the backgrounds are 2D, which I love, which I prefer. I think those backgrounds work a lot better than the sequel because they feel so detailed. And there's the little touches and the intros to each one. And you've got those like homages to the like, classic arcade games. You've got the cut like the 8-bit looking car game where it's going through, it's like driving through and then they crash and then it's the big explosion, and you've got the big like you fight, you've got the two characters fighting in front of a wreck, and then they've got the glow around them. where you've got lighting effects on it. It's just so cool. And then you've got like the final fight stage. It's all just fantastic stuff. It's four buttons on each for each, and I think that's just a nice change of pace. I always advocate six buttons for fighting games, which is why Capcom versus SNK2 I'm a little bit hot and cold on sometimes, but it's similar for this. It was a game that was different enough from everything else that came before. And it was a nice halfway house between Capcom and SNK. And I always thought, you know what, Capcom and SNK, two massive rivals. Obviously, a lot of history. Capcom made Street Fighter 1. The Street Fighter 1 staff defected to SNK. They made Fatal Fury as a spiritual sequel to Street Fighter 1. Capcom made the real Street Fighter 2, and two were just, rivals ever since. But 1999, the two, put their differences aside and make the crossover game to end all crossover games. Where do they make it? But for Sega hardware. So extremely special to me, that one.
Great shout, mate. I had a feeling that one would show up.
People will know us too well, mate.
That's it. That's it.
And one more from you, mate.
So the other one I had on my list here was Dead or Alive 2. Now, I know I've kind of, I think we've spoken about that kind of more than we had planned to. We've kind of went into it a wee bit in terms of the differences between the PS2 and the Dreamcast versions, the two Dreamcast versions. But I think as a game, I think Dead or Alive 2, or just Dead or Alive series, unfairly gets, first of all, pointed out as being, it's a fighting game with women with big tits, basically. It's just like bouncing boobs. But that is a betrayal of what a bloody good fighting game Dead or Alive is. It's got Dead or Alive 2 has got a fantastic counter system. It's the damage you can do. Just by perfectly timing that block button just to grab your opponent's arm as it reaches out, the timing, if you nail it, it's absolutely sensational. The stage design, the extra modes in the Dreamcast version, obviously you've got the story modes, which has got, cut scenes done in engine, beautifully done, which give great close-ups of the characters, just the facial expression and the detail, that kind of almost kind of anime style quality that the visuals have got. Whenever you're playing the game and the fighters are going at it and those beautifully giant, well animated, color detailed fighters are going at it on those stages. But it's just there's so much going on. It's such a very, very deep fighting game, brilliant mechanics to it. As I say, I think it's an injustice to it to just kind of focus on the kind of ample assets of the fighters. I know you can go into the settings and you can set your age to, have the kind of comedy effect bouncing and stuff like that. But you take all that away, you look at there's a great story in there. Like as I said, story mode's brilliant. End boss is a bit kind of cheap, the kind of bit of a cheap final boss. But the main mode is the story mode. The closest you get to an arcade mode is the time attack mode, which is a very traditional kind of best two out of three rounds kind of fight. You've got extra costumes in there, unlockables, tons of stuff, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. Like played today on like your kind of Kaiko HDMI on like a modern TV or a normal kind of like 1080p monitor. There's going to be jaggies. I know if you've got DC HDMI or DC digital, you can add those kind of filters to take that away. But back in the day, the way Dreamcast worked, and it was kind of John Linneman that obviously kind of educated both of us on this, was that, Dreamcast kind of very cleverly worked with how CRT technology worked, how its aliasing worked. That's what made it look as smooth as it did. So on a CRT back in the day, like Dead or Alive 2 on Dreamcast was just mind-numbingly smooth. It was like there was nothing. Like no jaggies at all on anything. It was absolutely stunning. And even today, played on, like whatever method you've got of playing it on a modern set, it still looks incredible. And it plays really good too. So I would say that's my final pick, mate. Dead or Alive 2.
And yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal looking. And yeah, play it fairly regularly. It's loads of fun. It's fast, it's frantic. It's just the pace of it is fantastic. And I think it probably is my favorite of the series still. Have I got all of them? Yeah, I have. I remember I got six and I was not too impressed with six or five. Three and four on the Xbox and Xbox 360 were okay, but none of them really had the impact like two. It's still the best in the series for me.
Aye.
Yep,
Totally.
and I don't
Go
think we
on, mate.
planned this. We didn't plan this, mate, but the last one I've got is also a fighting game, so we've closed off with three fighting games. And another obvious one as we take you for a ride, this is
Hey.
Marvel versus Capcom 2. And yes, I know I was bemoaning four attack buttons and 3D stages, but I do have my niggles with this one. But let's just be honest, in terms of iconic Dreamcast games, in terms of iconic fighting games, and games that have just a footprint on modern gaming, even today, you don't get much bigger than Marvel versus Capcom 2, especially with the size of the cast. You know, it set the it's almost criminal that the game's as well known and popular as it is, but it didn't move Dreamcast units the way it should have done. No, it's a great injustice. There's another fighting game. It's a great injustice that it didn't, but you know. Ports to loads of other systems. I've got the Xbox version. I've got the HD Xbox version as well. But the Dreamcast and the original Naomi are the ways to play it. Naomi works really well in the way that it unlocks characters while you're in the arcades. I never got to see that much of it in the arcade. I think it was in the Trocadero for a while. But it's just such a phenomenal game. Love the idea that you're able to take your VMU, take your save data and play it in the arcade. And in Japan, at least, you're able to rack up points on there to spend in the shop. Obviously, an absolute nightmare to anyone that buys the Japanese version now because you can't unlock everything. But that's
Hi.
thank God for a GDMU for that, because then I stuck the tool on there where you can create saves and put them on your VMU. And then you can get a completed get this game save. Ruins the idea of unlocking it all, but at least you get to play as all the characters. But you know, 56 characters, you know, as big as Marvel is or was, probably maybe not as much now. You know, it's always great to go back, and it's one that I do like to show my son it now and again, because obviously he's a big Marvel fan, and you know, they don't get much bigger than that. Was it 20, 26 characters on either side? Street Fighter icons. Jill Valentine was one of the new characters. Superb.
I mean that is one that whenever I had the disc version before my Dreamcast drive died and I decided to sack this, I'm going with a GDMU. But I actually unlocked every character in them. I've unlocked a lot of the extra colours as well. But yeah, when I earn points and I go into the shop, there's still extra colours getting given to me. There's just so much stuff to unlock in that game. It is ridiculous. But I it's weird. It's like the tone of it, that kind of jazzy soundtrack, as legendary as it is now, but at the time it was quite, you went, oh, it's like, oh, it wasn't kind of like you would expect for like a game with those that kind of those all those franchises mixed together, that it would have quite a kind of fast, kind of really hard hitting, powerful soundtrack. But it's like it's like elevator music, isn't it? It's like, aye, but nah, that is iconic.
It's another one where I'm like, sometimes I absolutely love the music and it's stuck in my head for ages, and sometimes I'm just like, this just doesn't suit the game at all.
And then, but it's like you get that wee jingle, and then it's like, who will survive again? It's like the wee voiceover guy comes in, and you're like, nice. I mean, that last boss, though, the three forms, Jesus Christ, that like you get the first one, and it's like the kind of the suit of armor with the big green kind of horns, and then you beat that, and it's the kind of what was inside that, the wee green goopy guy that fires his hand, turns into a kind of slime gun, and he fires
Goes
it. And then he turns into this big red demon that fills the entire screen. You're like, ah, right, okay.
Yeah, I was always a little bit let down by that boss because it's an original one, and I was just like, I don't know, I don't even know who you are. It's just, and it's so easy to cheese. I mean, the first one, you just crouch, block, he'll attack for eight. He'll attack. The attack will take ages. Then you hit him back a lot, and then he'll take ages to get into his attack frame again. The second one, you can just kill really quickly with just a projectile attacks, and then the third one. Isn't that so? I mean, compare that to Onslaught in Marvel versus Capcom 1. He's an absolute bastard, brilliantly so. And you know, obviously he's a character from the comics. It's like a warped version of Professor X. So, yeah, but no, it's still an absolutely sensational game. While you was talking just then, mate, I was checking CEX for
Go
Marvel
on,
versus
don't, mate.
Capcom 2,
Don't.
the
If,
Dreamcast version.
I'll tell you first of all, right, before you reveal how much it is now, right, I paid 45 quid for that back then.
I
That was
remember.
what, three and a half years ago,
Wasn't, yeah, it was
right?
only 3 or 4 years when we just
Yep.
started doing the podcast.
That's right. And I was building up a physical collection again. And the copy I got, I ordered it online in CEX's app. Mate, how the person that's traded us in didn't get mint for this. The manual still smelt new. It never, the pages were uncreased. The disc didn't have a mark on it. The hinges were perfect. There was no discoloration or tearing in the inserts. It was immaculate. And I was like, 45 quid. What a bargain.
Yeah,
What's
what a
today's
bargain indeed,
price?
man. With manual boxed, it's 90 quid. If it's mint, it's 100.
Jeez.
That's insane. Xbox version is 30 quid. PS2 version is 50 if you want a manual with it. It's absolutely unreal. But again,
Is this a new tier they've got with manual, without manual?
yeah, they got mate with manual, without manual, and mint now.
All right, okay. Just an extra way to rip people off then, I.
Yeah, I don't know how you get to mint, but that again just goes to show how well regarded the game is. I don't think it sold that well back in the day. Obviously, everyone loves it now, but back in the day, I don't think it sold as well as the reputation it has now would suggest.
Did Maximilian Dude not see even at the start? He didn't like it at the start, so he said that before. That's ringing a bell or something.
I can't remember
What was
Max
it?
saying it. I've definitely said it a number of times. As I say, I'm hot and cold on it, and overall I love it. Probably still prefer the first one, but you can't deny. Obviously, the first one is CPS2 rather than Naomi. You can't deny the impact of the game. It's still one of the greatest fighting games ever. I just wish it was like a six button and you could use the circle motions, like quarter circle forward and hit the two attack buttons rather than you just pull the triggers and everyone does everything.
Aye, and that's how you can cheese the last form in that final boss. See, if you just
Yeah.
build up your super to max and just wait for him to pop his head up and just go two triggers, boom, and then
Yeah.
everybody just unleashes on him. It's like, that was easy. Right, here we
Yeah.
go, mate. Who's your go-to team?
It changes, but usually it's Cyclops, Iron Man, and Ryu, which is quite a boring team because they're all the kind of Shoto characters. They all have very similar moves, and when they do, if you pull your two triggers and they do their combined team move, it's the Hadouken, it's the Optic Blast, and it's the Proto Cannon. 100 hits from the projectiles. What about you?
So I always just go Ryu for shits and giggles, War Machine, and Wolverine.
Which
I'll
Wolverine?
just go with the standard one, mate. I know there's an evil one in it. There's a
It's the Bone Claw one.
there was a Project X one or something they call it, isn't it? Was it the before he got
Yeah.
his adamantium, basically?
Yeah.
Aye.
Yeah. I think the only reason they had him in is because one plays like Marvel versus Capcom, the other one plays like X-Men versus Street Fighter or something from memory. It's just an excuse to have two different versions of Wolverine in there. But yeah,
I'm
mate,
trying to, I was
I think
just trying to
that's
think as well who the other who is he who's he Cable, the cheapest
Cable.
character in the
Oh God,
goddamn
yeah.
game.
That's the. I mean, the game is phenomenal. The game is so good. You get a few mates around, and it's such a laugh to play. But it's so broken, it's so unbalanced. It's really unbalanced. Whereas, as I say, compared to Marvel versus Capcom 1, it's not as tight. Final boss isn't as good. The music doesn't suit it as much. The 3D backgrounds aren't as good. But there's just so much of it. It's just such a big game, and it's just so chaotic that. It's still going to be a classic, still one of the all-time greats. That's why it's on my list. And of course, it's a Naomi game. It's came to Naomi, came to the Dreamcast, and that's where the birth of one of the greatest and most well-regarded fighting games of all time are. You frequently see Marvel vs. Capcom 2 on those greatest fighting games lists.
Late, mate.
But mate, that's another close to 2 hours, I think, of us nattering on about Sega.
What did we say? You sent me the kind of the layout for this when we went. I said, "Do I dare say the words? This won't be a long one."
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, a big one. I would never any other way, mate. I mean, if we weren't looking at the time, we could probably talk for longer than a pandemonium video.
Well, we were talking for about half an hour before we started the actual show, so
Yeah.
we've been here for nearly about best part of about 2.5 hours anyway,
We
so
have indeed, mate. But yeah, the Naomi, obviously, I think we'll be doing a few more videos on this as well, won't we? Obviously, it was great to sit down and chat about it. But you've got your post Dreamcast Naomi games, and I'm sure we'll be doing a lot more Naomi content in the future. So, viewers, listeners, hope you've enjoyed this. Get in touch. Let us know what your favorite Naomi games are. What games did you love coming to the Dreamcast? Or if there are any Naomi games, Guilty Gear XX is one that didn't come to the Dreamcast. Guilty Gear XX, Ninja Assault. There was plenty that didn't come to Dreamcast. What ones would you have loved to have seen? Please get in touch. You can do so via the comments below, via the Sega Guys Discord, or those of you in the Radio Sega Discord. How about you let us know what your favorite games are? And hey, thanks for getting in. Thanks for viewing. Thanks for watching. Thanks for making it to the end. If you've enjoyed it, give us a like or a subscribe. And if you want to be extra awesome, how about becoming a member, which you can do from as little as just 99 pence. And James, would you like to read out our big supporters for this episode?
certainly, our premium members, we have Andy Mackey, Sega Saturn Lad, G-Man, Stiff Peaks, I Am Mikowski, Craig Williamson, Sega Saturn, Shiro, Tom Thumb, Peter007, and that's us. That is
Brilliant.
what
So,
we have so far. So thank you very much to all of our premium members and our core members, as well as all of our subscribers. And if a monthly membership isn't your thing, no problem at all. We appreciate your support and liking, sharing, and subscribing. Get involved in the comments, get involved in the Discord. It's a little community that we've built over the last kind of almost coming up for 2 years on YouTube. So it's great to see you guys getting involved. So thank you very much.
yes, 2 years, it's absolutely flown by. So thank you everyone that has been supporting us. We hope you've enjoyed this. If you're new to the channel, please hit like and subscribe. We've got new Sega videos every week, new podcasts every fortnight, and every alternating Monday we'll have a new Sega video, and we usually do get an extra bonus video in during the week as well. So hey, there's plenty more to come from us. So until next time, we will see you on the Sega side.
Big up.